This is a CC Radio podcast.
Welcome everyone to this bonus episode of the countdown for February 2020. My name is Paul, and because this is a horror themed episode, no Wayne, because I've worked out this is how to do it. I'm a horror fan, I love horror movies, you all know that. Wayne hates them, so rather than torture him, which is kind of fun sometimes, and we'll continue to do that for the occasional review, but rather than doing lists on the topic that he hates, I thought, well, let's get in some awesome podcasters who also love horror, and we can talk about that. Been doing it last couple times last year with Sam from Movie Reviews and 20Qs, and this time, we've got Gerald from 2Ps on a podcast joining me today. Gerald, all the way from freezing North Carolina, how are you doing, man?
What's up, Sir Paul? I'm great, man. How are you? I am cold. You're right, I'm cold, but I'm thrilled to be here, man. You know I love you, and I love Wayne. Bummer that he's not into horror, but it's lucky for me, because I get to chat with you about it, so that's cool.
That's a nice way of putting it. And look, tell our listeners what you're putting yourself through to record this evening.
Well, there's snow on the ground. It's nothing crazy. We got about 1 to 2 inches here where I live. Some areas got about 3 to 4 inches, but like I said, nothing too crazy. But we had a minor snowstorm yesterday, and like I was telling you, the public just freaks out down here in the southern U.S. whenever something like that happens, because they only see it once a year, so it's like when it starts falling, they just don't know what to do. So it's not so much the conditions themselves, it's just the public stupidity when something like this happens.
Wow.
But I'm cold, man. I'm out in my garage.
Thank you.
Which I think is what you're referring to.
Yes.
And, you know, my family's home because we're recording in the evening and I have young kids and stuff like that. So I always pop myself out here, and it's actually not bad, man. I'm bundled up. I'm good to go. I don't want you to think that it's too bad, because I'm talking horror movies. I mean, I would sit outside if I had to do
that. that's why you're here, because you're such a fan like me. And today's topic is one that's near and dear to virtually every horror film fan's heart, at least those who were born around the time that we were. And that's the top 10 horror films of the 1980s, the entire decade. We're casting the net wide. No exclusions in terms of, oh, it's a mix of genres. If you determine it or I determine it to be a horror film, these are our favorite 10 of those examples. And regular listeners might know my very high ones, and there's no way around that. I'm not going to cheat and just push them out of it. I'm going to be truly honest. These are my 10 favorites. Sure. I agonized over it. It wasn't easy, but what about for you, Gerald? How'd you go with it?
Agony is a good way to describe narrowing this down. You know, we threw this together on the fly, Paul. You hit me up yesterday, or a couple days ago, I guess, initially, and I started making my list right away. You know, I started playing around on Letterboxd with some movies, and obviously did some Google searches and looked through my Blu-ray collection and things like that. And I had an initial list of about 25 movies, and I have 15 that I narrowed it down to. So I got 5 honorable mentions, and then, of course, my 10. But what I was telling you before we started recording, that was the toughest, is the order. Like, I have no idea. Like, my top two will probably never change. In my life.
Likewise.
They'll probably always be my top two. But other than that, I mean, my 3 could be my 9 one day, my 10 could be my 5 one day. Like, they're all so equal to me, and I love them all for so many different reasons, that with the exception of those couple just A++ movies that are always going to be my top two, it's kind of a crapshoot, and I just have so many favorites.
All right, well, we're going to hear all about them, and I can't disagree with that. Mine could change order readily. Like you, I've got 5 honorable mentions we'll run through quickly at the end that could sub in, especially for 10. My 10 is the one I'm least happy with, and I warred with it in my head, but I wanted to... Anyway, we'll get to that in just a few moments. But you are the guest, Gerald, so lead us away. What is your 10th best horror film of the 80s?
All right, well, look, man, a little disclaimer on my number 10. I'm kind of like you, where it's not like... You know, I don't know that this movie itself as a work is one of my absolute favorites, but this franchise is, and this is probably my favorite movie in the franchise, at least in the 1980s. But I'm going to name Jason Lives, Friday the 13th, 6.
Nice.
Is my number 10.
I don't think you should have an asterisk next to that choice. I'm glad that I'm glad you had the balls.
I just want to give Jason some love, man, to be honest. I mean, like I said, it's really a franchise pick, but you know, I know a lot of people are going to quote the first one, the original, which I do love, but we don't see Jason, you know what I mean? And he becomes part of the story much later. And Jason Lives was just a Jason showcase. It was cheesy, it was campy. You know, you had the kill scenes with the paintball players that didn't really make any sense, but it was a cool way for him to get his machete, you know, I guess.
Yeah, true.
And then obviously the lightning rod bringing him back to life out of the grave was just the stupidest thing that now when you watch it. But as a young kid seeing that, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I'm so scared, you know. But, 80s, yeah, I love this movie, man.
This is typical 80s. Like, we don't care. Let's just get this guy back or get this killer back, whatever way we need to. Who cares about Paul's ability? And I love the way they just lent into it and didn't make apologies for it. Like, this is as ridiculous as it can humanly be. And it was great having Tommy Jarvis back now as a as a young man rather than as a kid, like as played by Corey Feldman in the fourth one. So having that through line and you had a bit more connection to him, I think that helped the film as well. But then, yeah, it's just all about the kills. And from vague memory, there's close to 20 kills in this movie. And
a lot of pretty kills. Brutal. I think this one is has a reputation for having, if not the most, definitely one of the most kills of the franchise and definitely of 80s horror in general. And I love the kill scene in the camper when he puts the girl's face through the... Yeah, that's one of the best, most inventive kills of the whole series, too. So, you know, like I said, of the 80s, this is my favorite Jason movie, and I wanted to give Jason a little bit of love tonight, so that's my number 10.
Very nice. That's a good way to kick us off. My number 10 with an asterisk is a film that is synonymous in sort of growing up with horror for me. Like, I watched this pretty young with my mother sort of arms folded behind me, kind of like, I don't think you should be watching this type thing. But when I didn't freak out and have nightmares and the rest of it, I guess this was kind of a bit of a gateway drug for me in that sense. And I'm talking here about, technically, Toby Hooper's Poltergeist from 1982, though the scuttlebutt is Steven Spielberg actually directed the vast majority of it. And I think I've had that heard that confirmed by people on set now. Anyway, Poltergeist is that story, like a quintessential horror ghost story where Carol Ann is of course, the most iconic element of that film. The little girl who, of course, died not that long, Heather O'Rourke, not that long after Poltergeist 3, I think. Could be wrong. Could be after number 2, which, so that was very sad. But this family moves into this haunted house. Turns out to be built on Native American land, and that's part and parcel of it. Opens this gateway. The little girl gets taken through, Carol Ann, and then it's about the family's desperate attempts to bring her back. But there's just so many memorable parts of this movie, which obviously, for me, the clown was pretty scary as a kid. And the bit that stands out in my mind, apart from all the corpses falling out from where the pool was being dug at the end of the film, and the dad shoving the TV out of the hotel room at the very, very end, is the tree. That tree reaching in, basically, through in the storm, reaching in through the window and trying to grab the boy. That scared the shit out of me as a kid. Yep. And that's really stuck with me.
And I had a lot of trees outside my house, so that was not helpful for me either. But, you know, one thing that's cool about Poltergeist is this is actually one of the 5 honorable mentions that I have, so it just missed my list. But it was in the running for quite a while, and I do love this movie. I mean, it basically is a Spielberg film. His name's all over it. His kind of artistry is all over it. And Toby Hooper, too, man. I mean, come on. I mean, he's also a horror legend. So having those two dudes together involved in this. But one of the things I want to say about Poltergeist real quick, and then we can move on, is, you know, what they do in that movie that's really cool is they take one thing that really shouldn't be scary and they make it very, very frightening. And that's just the static on the television, man. You know, we don't get that a lot anymore in streaming culture. But I can remember when I saw that as a young kid and even into like my college years, and it's recent to maybe 10 years ago. Whenever I would see snow on TV, I just immediately think of that movie and those scenes. And it's just, it's kind of scary, man. You know, it's not really a scary thing, but Poltergeist turned it into a scary thing. You know?
Yeah, I agree. That's a really good point that you try and see things in the static much as sort of you're trying to in watching this movie. So, yeah, as you say, it's not a thing these days, but back then it most definitely was. Nice call.
Absolutely, man.
All right,
cool, man. So, you know, I did it with my number 10. I'm going to kind of do it with my number 9, too, although this might not be the last time I talk about this. But, and then people might consider this low, but my number 9, where did I get that from? My number 9 is from 1984, A Nightmare on Elm Street. Mr. Wes Craven, the original.
Yeah, a little low, I will acknowledge. Yeah.
Well, you know, I love the franchise, man. This is, you know, truth be told, not my favorite film of the franchise, but it did start it all.
And yes,
Freddy is a different kind of horror villain. You know, he's got the banter, he's got the humor, he has personality. You know, we're going to be talking about a lot of other killers that don't really have that personality. They just kind of stalk and kill and walk slowly, and that's just their whole thing, you know. But Freddy's just a character, man. And you know, a young Johnny Depp in this movie, some really, really cheesy practical effects that you didn't notice at the time, but when you look back on them now, you just, it's almost like a comedy at certain points. But I just love it, man. Wes Craven is a master, and this was the birth of Freddy. So I could not put it in my top 10 as my number 9.
I think this, you said cheesy. I think some of the special effects in this movie really hold up. Like Johnny Depp's death
scene. Well, some of them do.
Is but, phenomenal.
Go ahead. Oh, absolutely.
When he gets sucked into the bed and the geyser of blood comes out. And then, is it Tina? With the way she's ragdolled around the bedroom and up on the ceiling. And it, that's, for 1984, that's some pretty incredible stuff.
I agree, man. That scene alone is enough to put this movie on the list. Just a tremendous scene. It was really groundbreaking, too. I mean, there would have been some other things done that I'm going to talk about in a little bit that I think it borrowed from.
Okay.
But we hadn't seen it in a kind of big budget slasher at that point. Do you know what I mean? And I thought that scene was awesome. I agree with you.
And the idea that this is not just idiot kids heading off to somewhere stupid and doing things they shouldn't do. This was normal kids going to sleep.
Right, right.
So that was genius as well.
Yeah, and that's why Freddy was so unique and inventive and just cool, man, because it was so different. And it was, again, something that we shouldn't be afraid of. I mean, all of us have to sleep. I mean, you have to. Your body, you know, forces you to. And, of course, there's nightmares and things like that. But, I mean, just the thought of going to sleep shouldn't really scare you, but it does in this situation.
So. Yeah, well, that's, as you said, the genius of this particular film. So, yeah, that's a good choice. And we'll be hearing how high it goes on my list. At some point. My number 9 is a controversial one, no doubt about it. It's the film in this trilogy which people like the least as a general rule, but this was the one that I saw arguably I saw it first even, which seems blasphemous now, but at the time I had no idea sort of the way this all worked, and I just remember being really freaked out by the zombies in this movie, and I'm a big zombie film fan. I'm talking about George A. Romero's 1985 conclusion to his Dead trilogy, Day of the Dead.
Good one.
This one for me, it's just that sort of claustrophobia, the idea of the group of antagonistic people stuck, even the fact it was an underground base kind of played with my sort of fear sensibilities just a little bit. I don't like the idea of being, you know, spelunking or going down very low and then having the dead just amassed above your base waiting for any opportunity to get in. Eventually, cabin fever and sets in and one dude lets them in and then it's just carnage, and there's some of the best kills, zombie kills in film history here with Tom Savini working his magic, and George Romero doing a really great job of that. It's kind of got no real ending, like the survivors just basically get in the helicopter and fly off, and that's the extent of it, but it really brought a sense of, this stuff, it's pretty full on. The makeup was incredible and the kills awesome, especially Rhodes, which is one of the most famous kills in cinema history.
I was going to mention that one too, actually. Yep, I agree. I love this pick. I mean, I'm surprised. I didn't know that this would be the Romero pick or the one that would zombie pick that would get thrown here. I have a zombie pick coming up on my list. It's not this one. And I limited myself to one zombie pick in my top 10.
Oh, I didn't.
Well, I know you're probably much more of a bigger fan of that subgenre than I am, so I understand that. But I have one coming up high on my list, but it's not this one. So.
I wonder if it'll be the same. We shall see. All right, that's
great
mine.
Pick, though. Great pick.
Thank you. Over to you for your number 8.
All right, man. My number 8 is... so I have a few. I'm going to have a run on some kind of independent, kind of underground horrors. You know, the early to mid-80s, like 1980 to 1984, maybe 5, you could say, really, was like the renaissance of just kind of the B-slasher, you know, the B-movie slasher. And this movie has just always been one of my favorites. I saw it when I was young, probably like 10 years old, which I was way too young to see it. So when you see something that young, it just sticks with you, man. And it has for so many years. I watch it every single winter, every single holiday season. From 1984, it's Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep. I love this movie, man. Very campy. I mean, have you seen this?
Yeah, but such a long time ago, and I don't know, it didn't make the impression on me. It clearly has on you, so tell us about it.
Well, I watch it every year, man. For really the last, like, 20, 25 years, I watch this every year. But, I mean, come on, man. It's a dude named Billy. He's a young guy who, basically based on his childhood, has kind of lost his mind, for lack of a better way to put it. He was at a work party playing the proverbial Santa Claus at the work party, at the Christmas party, when he snapped and when he lost his mind. And he just goes on a killing spree dressed as Santa Claus. You know, throughout the movie, there's these nice little touches of kind of drama and almost heart in a weird way because he connects to all the kids in the movie because of what he went through as a kid. So there's a lot of very tense scenes where he actually encounters children and you think, oh, God, you know, is this kid about to, you know, get it? And he'll he'll spare the kids in every scenario. And then sometimes he even helps them. There's one scene in this movie, I don't know if you remember, but these two dudes were bullying these young boys. And there's a scene where one of the bullies is sledding down a hill and he chops his head off with an axe. And when the sled gets to the bottom of the hill, it's the headless friend. And he's like,
I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, just a lot of great kills. There's an awesome, like, I hate to even use the term beautiful, but, you know, like almost like a Ari Aster type imagery. But there's a really beautiful kill scene with one of the girls getting placed into very slowly into the antlers of this deer. What do you call it? Taxidermy that's on mm-hmm. the wall or whatever. Yep, yep. I don't know if you remember that. Really cool and like artistic kill scenes in this movie. But, you know, I could have stopped at Santa Claus, somebody dressed as Santa Claus on a killing spree. You know, that's enough for me in the holiday season. A lot of blood in the snow imagery in this movie. But yeah, I would say revisit it, man.
I might have to.
For you and for anyone that just loves 80s horror, especially if you want to do it at the holiday season, it's a great watch, man.
Well, there you go. Wasn't expecting it, but nice choice then. We'll give it another bash. My number eight.
All right.
Funny you say that whole indie sort of 80s renaissance of horror, because my number eight fits squarely into that window. It's a film which probably wouldn't have had the impact that it's had on the cultural zeitgeist and the movement of horror if not for the recommendation of one Stephen King, who said basically The Evil Dead was flat out amazing horror film, and it launched the careers of Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. And we are still, well, up until what, 2 years ago, we're still getting Evil Dead content, and they still keep talking about redoing it. You watch that movie, it's so low budget, so unpolished, it's so like every single dime is up there on the screen, and some of it's way too ambitious, and you laugh at it from a 2020 sort of standpoint. But in 1981, that shit was cutting edge and chilling to the bone, and it was a straightforward horror, this one. There's a couple of comedic moments, but largely, this is just, I'm trying to scare the pants off you, and people really were back in that age. And this was one I begged to watch for many years. I think I was probably, wasn't allowed to watch it until I was about 11 or 12, just before Evil Dead 2 came out, and I loved Evil Dead 2 as well, which we might hear a little later. But anyway, yeah.
I was going to say, that's a great one too. I didn't know how you choose, but maybe you didn't. I don't know.
Yeah. The Evil Dead is my number eight, and it's a classic, and I don't need to sell it, I think, any harder than that.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's my number 11. It just missed my top 10. But, you know, when I did this 10, though, Paul, and you know this about me, I mean, these are my 10, man. So Evil Dead is one of those movies, and Evil Dead 2, really, where I just I respect them so much, and I do go back. I do revisit them frequently. But I didn't grow up with them. I saw them much later, like after I was already a horror fan and after I had already kind of seen so many other things.
Okay,
so I think, had I seen it like some of the ones that are on my list, like when it came out in the 80s, it probably would rank much higher personally for me, but I'm never going to refute anyone for choosing it. I mean, it's a masterpiece, so.
It's the only DVD I own, which is this ridiculously special edition. Like, it's got this, it's actually put in like this latex Book of the Dead, and it was phenomenal. It sits, even though I put all my other DVDs away now, because it obviously moved on to Blu-ray and 4K and all the rest of it. There you go, people playing bingo at home. This is one that stayed out on the shelf because of that awesome sort of package that it came in. So it's got a special place in my heart for that reason as well.
Hey, man, I buy 4Ks too. I'm with you, brother. You get it? All right, well, what are we up to? My number seven, right? Okay. Yep. So another campy indie underground horror that has since gained a cult following. At the time, it got bashed by everyone in critic circles. Anyone that saw it hated it. I was, again, very, very young. I don't remember my exact age. I was probably also around 10 years old when I saw it. And, you know, this is one of those where I keep myself in that moment. You know, I don't put myself in 2020. I put myself in 1983 when Sleepaway Camp came out.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So that's my number seven. The reveal at the end, man, the plot twist at the end with Angela. And, I mean, have you seen this, first of all? Do you want me to do spoilers or not?
If you haven't seen a film from 1983, yeah, you don't really care enough. So, yeah, absolutely, spoil away.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, the reveal at the end where this young, timid, shy girl who's basically been the protagonist throughout the entire movie, who's, you know, being bullied. She's the underdog. She goes to this camp. She doesn't want to be there. And she's really out of place. And then the reveal at the end to find out not only has she been the antagonist, and she's actually been the killer that we've been kind of doing a whodunit for the whole 90 minutes, but she's also a boy. and you find that out. I'm sure you remember that if you saw it.
Sure do.
But, you know, it's a shot of her dick, however you want to phrase that, her penis, and her holding her boyfriend's decapitated head. She gives out this just growl scream at the end with a very distorted kind of score playing behind it. And it's a very haunting ending and a very unlike blind sight. I mean, nobody in 1983 saw that
way.
No one. So not only did they not see it coming that she was the killer, they didn't see it coming that she had been the survivor from the scene, the very first scene in the movie, and that, you know, they raised this, what was a young man, they raised to be a woman, and that's who we knew as Angela. So, you know, the plot twist at the end is really what does it for me, because I can remember seeing it and just like having to be like, what the fuck did I, what? Like, you just don't know what's happening. Do you know what I mean? And you have to kind of second guess yourself and rewatch it. And I love it, man. I revisit this one frequently too. And, you know, I was just able to introduce this one to my daughter. You know, she's 18 now, so we watch, you know, anything and everything together. Nice. But she's into the old cinema, you know, because she wants to do film. And I'm like, well, let's watch some 80s horror. So we watched a ton of 80s horror this past October. And this was one of the ones I just rewatched with her a few months ago. So, yeah, Sleepaway Camp, my number 7. You a fan of that one or not?
I didn't mind it. I don't think it hit me the same way. I think maybe a little bit like you described The Evil Dead. I didn't watch this one until much later. And I think I knew the twist before I watched it from vague memory. So,
oh, okay, yeah.
So
I heard it then.
Yeah, a lot. And because it is such low budget and it is so rough around the edges, shall we say, it didn't impact on me the same way it has on you and clearly others over time.
No, I can see that. And I know that that's a thing, man, because if you don't see this, and, well, I mean, I guess, I mean, the time for sure, because it is definitely a 1983 film. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. Also, if you know the ending, then it's not going to have little to no impact on you. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I can see that 100%.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you for that choice. And there's a bit of an education in what the difference between 1983 and 2020. You couldn't get away with that film in 2020, by the way.
Exactly.
No way. All right. Well, by number 7, you could, though. No one would be upset if you went to redo this. And in fact, they did redo this last year as a TV show. My number 7 is George A. Romero. Again, his 1982 film, Creepshow.
Nice. Nice.
Still, to this day, the best anthology film that I have ever seen. It's 5 stories taken from the old EC comics of the 1950s with the Crypt Keeper kind of introducing each of them. And not all of them are great. Like, I don't really like the Stephen King story about basically turning into a plant person. That didn't do a whole hell of a lot for me. But
right.
The genius of an anthology film, like a book of short stories, is you don't like one, it's over pretty soon, and then you're into the next one. The downside being you do like one, it's over pretty soon and you're into the next one. But this is 2 hours long. There's enough time spent with each of these particular stories. There's some incredibly good gore in this. Even the first one, Father's Day, where the dead horrible patriarch comes back and seeks revenge on his money-hungry family. All the way through to the Leslie Nielsen, Ted Danson one where he murders his wife and her lover and they come back from the dead. That was really scary as a kid watching those two corpses sort of lumbering through the house trying to get to him. So there's a couple other stories obviously as well. The Crate is a good one. Just awesome. Written by Stephen King and this is of course his acting debut, but that's your mileage will vary on that. Let's put it that way. But otherwise, did you like Creepshow?
I did, man. I didn't see the... you were just saying they did a TV show, and I actually went to check that out, and I haven't yet. I actually prefer Creepshow 2, though, I think because of The Raft.
Funny you say that. It's on my honorable mentions, and it says exactly that, mainly for The Raft.
Yeah, I mean, that innocuous puddle or whatever that just...
So good.
That, I mean, that's just, you know, creepy, and it's in broad daylight, and it's just... I don't know. That was awesome, man. The I don't remember the name of the story either, but the... you know, like convenience store Indian story too. I remember I liked that one a whole lot. So I think I prefer Creepshow 2, but I also haven't seen Creepshow in a while. I just watched Creepshow 2 this past October, but I need to go back now that you named it and rewatch 82's Creepshow because I do remember that out very fondly as well.
Yeah, you really should. It does stand up because it's that kind of timeless quality in that it's adapting 1950 stuff in 1982, so it's not as egregiously on the nose fashion aside. So yeah. That's my number 7.
Love it, man. All right, so my number 6, you can't have a 80s horror list, in my opinion, or I guess I can't have an 80s horror list without Cronenberg. So I'm going to pick 1986, The Fly.
Of course, yep.
Starring Jeff Goldblum. Obviously, this is a remake. It originally starred Vincent Price, I want to say in the 50s.
I think you're right.
But yeah, But yeah, I mean, well, Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, but a story of a man just, I mean, yes, he's turning into a fly, but this man is just losing every part of him. You know, he's losing who he thinks he wants to be, but also who he was. And it's a really inventive sci-fi story where it's these two like pods, and he's in one pod trying to teleport himself, and a fly gets stuck in the empty pod. And because the fly crossed the stream, so to speak, with him, they start to become each other, and he starts to take on characteristics of this fly. And by the end of this movie, when he's full blown, you know, fly, I mean, this is a disgusting. It's just amazing special effects, and just Cronenberg's touch is all over it. It's just a very beautiful creature feature. There's a very unique love story that Gina Davis sticks with this guy for so long. You know, he's still himself inside there, and there's a little bit of commentary in that too, I think. But yeah, I love it, man. It's one of my favorite creature features. I actually got to see it on the big screen at my local Alamo last year, which was awesome because I never did that when I was young.
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
Nice.
The Fly. That's my pick, man.
Yeah, there's something special about being able to go back to a film like this. One horror on my list I did a couple of years ago, which I'll talk about when I get there, and it was the first time I got to see it in a cinema, and it just added to that experience so much. So, yeah, I totally understand that bumping it up. But it's a classic pick. It's not on my list, not even on my honorable mentions. I'm not as big a fan of body horror as some, but there's no denying right. It's classic. And I think the casting in this film, particularly Jeff Goldblum, who these days is a suave, sexy motherfucker. Just listen to So I Married a Movie Geek in terms of Justin and Chrissy's experiences with him. But back then in the 80s, he was a bug-eyed looking weird dude, I reckon.
Yeah.
So yeah. Spot on casting as far as I'm concerned.
It really was him and Davis. I mean, they both just killed it in that movie.
Yeah, she was very, very good as well. So yeah, there we go. Nice choice there for your number 6. Can't believe we haven't had a crossover yet, Gerald. This is weird.
I know, me too. It's really crazy.
Well, I'm about to change all that because my number 6, here's where I stuck, A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay, all right. I mean, obviously, I agree with you.
Said everything I need to say, so straight back to you for the top half of the list.
All right, well, guess what? I'm on my 5, right? So let's...
Yep.
I'm going to stay with Freddy. Believe it or not, it's the Dream Warriors. Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
You did double up. Okay, I was about to say, probably right on par with Nightmare on Elm Street as a Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors for me. It's very, very close, but I wanted to give the OG the credit for creating, obviously, the character and Wes Craven's work on that. But this is directed by Chuck Russell, this one, and it's phenomenal. It's like Freddy evolving to that sort of quippy awesomeness, but I'll let you talk about it because it's actually your number 5.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, man. I mean, Chuck Russell, you know, Heather Langenkamp coming back as Nancy. It's some of the most inventive kills that will just never leave your psyche if you're a Freddy fan. You know, the face in the TV is probably my favorite, you know. Welcome to the primetime, bitch. You know, the syringe fingers, the needle fingers, when he injects his one victim. Mm-hmm. Just so memorable, was so inventive, and just stuff we had never seen before. And like you said, I mean, he was at the height of his comedy in Dream Warriors. I mean, he was like finally, he went from like little kind of mumblings to like, I'm a stand-up comedian now, you know. He was just like making you laugh, and you were so scared of him, especially if you were a young kid, which, you know, this came out in 87, so I would have been 12 years old when it came out,
yep,
maybe
likewise.
13. So, you know, you were scared of him at 13 years old, but you also couldn't help but kind of giggle a little bit at some of the shit he was saying to these guys right before he killed him, you know. But yeah, I love it. The scene where he's the puppet master, and I don't remember the character's name, that falls out of the window.
Cuts
the strings or whatever. So just so inventive, man. I mean, and we've never seen anything like that since, really. And, you know, what we said earlier when we were talking about the original, too, is like, you know, this is all in their dreams. It's all in their mind, which makes it that much more frightening because you would think they would be able to control it, and they can't when Freddy gets a hold of them. So Dream Warriors is by far my favorite Freddy film, so I knew it was going to be higher on my list than anything else.
Fair enough.
You know, I also love New Nightmare, but that's 90s. But,
yes, that was a good reinvention. Yeah. I agree. And this is the pinnacle. After this, each particular sequel is the Law of Diminishing Returns. 4 is good, but not as good. 5's pretty trash. 6 is just terrible. And then it reinvents itself with A New Nightmare. So, yeah. Good.
Thanks,
pick,
man.
Good pick, sir. All right, my number 5 is another zombie film. And it's one that was a bit of an offshoot from the Dead trilogy. It's Return of the Living Dead, directed by Dan O'Bannon, one of the writers of Alien in 1985. I watched this film again. There's a theme here. Way too young. Watched it with my best mate at the time. Still one of my best mates now. And I just remember being completely freaked out by Tarman, who is to this day, in my mind, still the best zombie, other than maybe some of them on The Walking Dead, but the best zombie put on screen, on the big screen ever. Phenomenal. It was played light and comic around that, but that's the stuff of nightmares right there, that particular zombie. And then the fact that they could speak, some of them could, and tell you what it was that what they were doing and why they were doing it. Some immortal lines, you know, why do you eat brains? Because the pain of being dead. That's terrifying in and of itself, I think, at an existential level. And then, you know, send more paramedics.
I love it. Yep.
To say nothing of a young man who sees arguably one of the first pairs of breasts I've seen in a film where the goth chick or the punk chick stands up and starts dancing and she's talking about the worst way to die for me being eaten alive by old men. And of course, that's exactly what happens.
It's exactly what happens to her, yep.
And then if it ends with them all being killed. That's the thing that really scarred me. Like, hang on, no one survived? They just bombed the shit out of it all? Like, wow.
Yeah, this is on my list. This is the zombie pick that I was talking about. So we have a little more crossover here. It's a little higher on my list because this is my favorite movie.
Talk about it now. Talk about it now and tell us what you love about it.
I mean, the only thing I really wanted to add, I mean, you perfectly nailed it, but I mean, the soundtrack to this movie, the music, it's a punk rock. It's an 80s punk rock movie with zombies roaming around in it, and the zombies that are in it reinvented the genre. You already said it. I mean, they talked. They almost like they knew what they were doing, where most zombies leading up to this, if not all of them, were just kind of mindless, numb, just roaming the countryside. And here they had an agenda and they were kind of smart. And, you know, that whole thing about eating brains, we take that for granted now in the zombie genre. That started here. You know, actually, that was when it was first uttered, was like brains was in this movie in Dan O'Bannon's flick. And they, you know, it has that title on it, Return of the Living Dead, and they actually pay homage to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead by actually mentioning the movie in this movie. I don't know if you remember that. They have a whole conversation about that film and how it was scary and so on and so forth, and it's kind of like meta in that way, and paying homage to what really got them there. They wouldn't be making that movie without Romero, obviously. So, yeah, I mean, I just love this movie. It was so self-aware, and it was so inventive to a genre that, you know, if this movie had not happened, and those types of kind of tropes were not introduced to this genre, I don't know that zombie movies would be nearly as successful as they are today. I feel like this added so much more to that subgenre. And I absolutely love it, man. It's my favorite zombie movie ever, personally. So it's my number three on my list. Damn. So yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. Wow. Best zombie film ever. That's I do remember your discussions about it, but that's pretty damn cool.
So that was my number three, but I'll go ahead and give you my number four real quick. Can we do that?
Yes. Over to you for your number four.
Okay, cool. So my number four is another indie underground that is frankly underseen, and I wanted to ask you if you had seen it before I spoil a bunch of stuff about it. But it just makes the cut, no pun intended, because it came in at 1980, but it's a film called Maniac.
Oh, yeah, I've seen Maniac, yep.
So Maniac, for me,
surprised.
Man. Yeah, it's... you know, similar in the same vein as like my Silent Night pick. It's... very campy and very independent. You know, this, I don't know if you know, but William Lustig, the filmmaker that directed this film, was a porn filmmaker prior to this. And he used a lot of his own money from the adult film industry in the 1970s. And he was a horror fanatic and he wanted to make a horror movie. What I tell people when I talk about Maniac is I tell people, to me, it's like if David Lynch made a horror movie. It's a very Lynch-esque kind of just weird auteur movie, but it is obviously a horror at its core. But what's cool about Maniac to me and what's so scary about that movie and so horrific, which is where the term horror comes from, is that it's the only movie on my list that's not like a far-fetched kind of supernatural, like out there storyline. I mean, this is basically the Son of Sam in New York in the 1970s. It's literally a serial killer who's a very disturbed individual who is stalking women that meet a certain profile to him. And when he kills them, he's scalping them and placing the scalps on these mannequins that he's collected in his home. And you know what I mean? Like,
I do.
It's fucking, you know, saying it's not like Freddy in your dreams, or it's not like this Jason guy who can't be killed by a bullet. I mean, this is like a real dude that's just a creep who's just stalking women. And what they do is they have that kind of disturbing storyline, and they incorporate a lot of horror tropes that we're used to, like the jump scare music. You know, the score in this movie is a very horror-centric score, and it feels like a horror movie when you're hearing it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And a lot of the kind of kills and the way the slashes come through, you can see the horror, you know, influence there. But this movie is just so real to me, man, which makes it scary. You know, it's just like a real, it's almost like the first Halloween, like Michael Myers, if that was it. If he was just a stalker of babysitters and he killed people, but he eventually met his demise and he got shot or arrested or whatever, and that would be the end of the movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why we haven't seen, you know, 12 Maniacs, because sequels, I mean, because it's just a story about this serial killer stalking women, and it's very scary if you think about it in those terms.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Were you a fan of this one?
It was pretty grimy and hard to like for me. I understand exactly what you're talking about. I probably watched it too young to truly appreciate it, and I should give it another go. I did see the remake with Elijah Wood probably 7, 8, 10 years ago, something along those lines, and obviously that wasn't as impactful and kind of disappeared the way most of these remakes do. Yeah. But everything you're saying about it is, you know, it makes sense. And the fact that it is so real and grounded, but also so grimy and gross, I guess that lends that air of horror to it that obviously you appreciate.
Right, right. It's a very creepy watch, and it's very unsettling. But yeah, a cool thing, Tom Savini's in this. Did you know that?
Ooh.
So Tom Savini was a makeup artist, and he, I don't know if you know the scene where he gets his head blown off by the double barrel shotgun, but that's Tom Savini.
Okay, don't remember it off the top of my head, but doesn't surprise me.
It's a great scene. You should watch it on YouTube. It's hilarious. But he just gets on the hood of the car and literally puts a double barrel shotgun in Tom Savini's face and just blows his head off.
Nice. Did he work on the film? Was he at the makeup?
He did. Artist? Yeah, it was a makeup effect. Yeah,
makes sense.
The reason he got the part is because he made a mold of his own head for that scene, and they were like, "Well, you have to play the character now because it's your head that's going to get blown off."
Very nice.
So, yeah. So Maniac's my number four, man. Sorry, right. I went on and on about it. I get passionate, man, when I get down here to my top five. I'm sorry, buddy.
You know, you're the guest. You're allowed to go on and on. And these are, we're getting into our very favorites now. And the only reason I won't go on and on about my top three is just I talk about them so often. My number four, though, I don't talk about as much. And yet, this was the first one that went on my list when we agreed to this topic, because it is everything that Maniac isn't. It's fun. It's still gross, but in a different kind of way. And it's by Chuck Russell again. This is the 1988 remake of the Steve McQueen starring The Blob.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Have you seen this one?
Yeah, I have. It's been a long time, but I have. This actually came up with our buddy Jeff, our mutual friend from Cadavercast, mentioned this one.
Yeah. When,
The Blob. I believe we were talking about horror kills, I think, and he mentioned it.
There's a bunch of good ones in this. This film, aside from starring Johnny Drama from Entourage in a much younger role, and Shawnee Smith, who was kind of a bit of a crush of mine around this sort of age, he was like in this film, and Who's Harry Crumb, and ended up on Becker, I think, with Ted Danson, that TV show. But this is just small town America invaded by this gelatinous blob which eats everything in its path, particularly flesh, or maybe specifically flesh. And there's some of the most amazing kills, as Jeff from Cadavercast mentioned in this film, from, you know, guy making out with a girl who's been eaten from the inside out in his car, to some of the other, I don't want to spoil, oh, I will spoil again, it's a 32-year-old film. But this film's pretty surprising in who it kills and how it kills them. Like, it's brutal. Other than arguably the main two characters, these other people you think are going to be there right to the end, they get offed very early in the piece, and some of them in pretty amazing fashion, and then it all turns out to be a government experiment out of hand, and the government's got its hand in it, and that's a cool little twist on the original as well, rather than just being this space monster that happened to land on Earth. I watched this film at least every 3 or 4 years, so I must have seen it now 7 or 8 times, and it's never not entertaining. It blows by, it's really quick, it's only 95 minutes long. I love the shit out of it. That's why The Blob is my number four.
Well, I need to give this a watch, man, because that's Jeff mentioned it this past October, and now you're mentioning it, and I want to rewatch it after talking to him, and I didn't get around to it this past Halloween, but I'm going to have to put it on the to-do list, man. I just haven't seen it in so long.
That's it.
Good pick, bud.
Give another bash. All right, thank you. All right, getting really high now. You're number three.
Well, my number three is Return of the Living Dead,
so we talked about. You mentioned that.
So that's my zombie pick, so back to you.
And my number three... Yeah, it is back to me. My number three is the sequel to the earlier mentioned Evil Dead. It's Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn. By far, my favorite Evil Dead film. And Evil Dead anything. This is the perfect blend of horror and comedy. This is Ash becoming the hero, reluctant that he is, while still being a bit of a smarmy asshole. Bruce Campbell is perfect in this film. Sam Raimi is one of his best mates, their best mates, and puts him through the ringer in terms of the shit they do to him. The budget's a bit bigger. There was rights issues, so they had to redo the start of the film to make it seem like a standalone film. But it's glorious. It ends in the most weirdly wicked way. It's got some iconic moments like Ash cutting off his hand and the hand becoming an antagonist and then outfitting himself with a chainsaw arm and this ultra cool sort of shotgun, sawn off shotgun on his back. And that's the image that I will always associate with the Evil Dead series, that and a camera being dragged through the woods in this really cool way as well. I love it so much. Inventive. I saw this back at the cinema 2 years ago with listener Jared. That was phenomenal. It was in a 4K restoration. It's one that I have picked up since. It's never going to look as good as it does now, and I just love the fucking shit out of it. That's why it's my number three.
Nice. I love it too, man. The Evil Dead, the first one made my honorable mentions. This one did not, but I love both of them pretty much equally. Like I said earlier, I feel guilty, but I just wish I had seen them in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? I saw them much later.
Sure.
I do love them, and I do respect their place on this list, so good pick, man.
All right, I wonder if our two and one are going to be the same.
Well, I don't know. I know one of them we cross over on. I don't know if it's going to be in the same position, though, but I'll say it, and then you all let me know. But my number two is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Low!
How could it be low, bro? That's number two.
I'll let you do the maths.
I was almost positive that this would be on your list, too, because I've heard you mention it a few times. But, yes. I mean, it's a masterpiece, man. I mean, it's actually, we do a top five show, and I've actually put it on like five or six lists.
There it is.
Just, whatever I could fit it on, you know what I mean? So, I love it. It's just, what else can we say about it, man? Just the winter setting, the kind of just hopelessness that exists throughout the movie because they're kind of trapped in the scenario that they're in. The creature effects are just unbeatable, man. I mean, just the practical effects in this movie are amazing. The spider head thing is just fucking, nightmare fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And, Kurt Russell. I mean, you and I could literally talk about this movie for an hour, but I'll save some commentary for you. But I absolutely love it. John Carpenter is one of my favorite filmmakers. I prefer 1978's Halloween to this one, but this is easily my number two film from Carpenter's catalog. I love it, man. So The Thing is my runner up.
Well, it's obviously not my runner-up, so you can probably do the maths on where it is, but the thing is, for me, exactly everything you said, and I've talked about it enough, but it's a film which holds up insanely well because of how amazing the practical effects are, and the setting is kind of timeless, and other than one or two ropey shots in there towards the end of the film, which I know that Carpenter himself wasn't exactly happy with, this is a near-perfect horror film, and it is my favorite horror film of all time, which is why it's my number one in the top 10 horror films of the 1980s, which just leaves us to know what my runner-up is and what your number one is. And I now reflect on what I said before. I can understand why my number two may not be on your list because it's a horror, sci-fi, action film.
I know what it is.
Yeah, the greatest sequel ever made.
I left it. Yeah, I didn't. Go ahead.
No, I totally understand why I did because I didn't put it on there till late. But then, like, every list I saw online for 80s horror films had it on there, and I'm like, well, if everyone else is calling it a horror film, even though it's not a straight horror film, and we are casting the net wide, that's why Aliens, James Cameron's Aliens, is my number two horror film of the 80s.
Yeah, do it, man. I'll let you talk about it, obviously, but I just to explain myself, I did think of that more as a sci-fi, and is a horror movie. Don't get me wrong. But also the other thing is I love the original. Like
I heard you say this recently.
Yeah. And I know you and probably the majority, if I'm being honest, prefer the sequel. And the sequel is amazing. I mean, I'm not going to say anything negative about it. But I think the reason I love the original so much is because I saw it when I was 8.
Yeah, I would be much older.
I crept into my living room. My parents were watching it, I think, on VHS tape. And I kind of hid in the shadows and watched it. And I saw the scene of Kane's chest burster and I literally have never been the same since, and that was when I was 8 years old. So still the most frightened I've been in my life was that night, having to sleep that night. So that impacted me so much. It was just slow burn too that paid off so well. And I'm talking about the original, but anyway, Aliens is cool because it takes that recipe and it just dials it up to 11, man. But I'm sure you're about to pine over, so go ahead. But I think it's a great pick, man.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a very similar memory about Alien. I didn't get to watch it, but I remember a very early babysitter. We were talking about movies even back then, and him saying, the best film I've ever seen is Alien. You should watch that when you're old enough. I'm like, oh, okay. So that got stuck in my head. And then funnily enough, The Thing I was allowed to watch all the way up to where the dog's head explodes open with another babysitter, the next door neighbor who was looking after us one night when I must have been only 7 or 8 years old. And he just stopped it. He said, time for bed. And I'm like, ah. So it has
it's
that
just getting good, man.
Mystique in my head, which I then had to wait however long before I was allowed to watch it. A couple of years, I would imagine. And it just hung over me that whole time. But yeah, Aliens, I won't go on about it because everyone knows what I think about this film, or indeed what everybody thinks about this film. Just an incredible blending of sci-fi and action and horror. There's some incredibly creepy moments in this film, but it's not as big a horror film, I agree with you, as the first one, because that is a straightforward gothic horror in space, haunted house film, if you like, in space.
Sure.
And if we ever did a top 10 horror films of the 70s, I guarantee Alien would be very high.
Oh, no fucking question.
On that list
absolutely.
As well.
I just put Ripley as my number one badass movie woman, too, of all cinema. I mean, irrefutable. You know, and she beat out Laurie Strode, which for me is like fucking unimaginable. So you know I'm a big fan of it, brother.
Yeah, there you go. And I think you've touched on something I should mention to wrap it up, but the characters in Aliens, like, I can't think of a better film still to this day which has a more identifiable and engaging support crew of characters. Like, not so much the ones that get bumped off early, but even Apone, who does die pretty early, he's pretty incredible. But then everyone who's left after that initial attack, they're all extremely memorable, extremely well-defined characters. And that's something that modern-day films or horror films don't do particularly well. You'll get the first 1, 2, maybe 3 characters, and everyone after that is just cannon fodder. So I wish we could return to a land where you cared about most, if not all, of the characters rather than waiting for them all to die to get down to the important ones.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All right, that's therefore my list, because we know my number one. The only thing left then is to hear Gerald's number one.
I wonder if you know, but I've actually mentioned this one on a few different lists we've done on my show before too. This is, it just made the brief because it came out in 1980. I know that the source material is Stephen King, and I know that he has come out vocally, not so much against this version, but just that he's not a huge fan of it.
Yep.
With all that being said, I'm basing it on what my eyeballs see and what I feel from a horror imagery standpoint. Obviously, I'm talking about The Shining, directed by Stanley Kubrick from 1980.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. I feel like this is the best horror movie of the 1980s, and it would probably be in the top 3 to 5 horror movies of all time. The imagery that Kubrick takes this King lore and, I mean, come on, man, the twins in the hallway, the blood coming off the elevator. We were talking about Nightmare on Elm Street earlier. You know, that scene was a little reminiscent to scenes like that in Kubrick's film. And what he does is he establishes a very, very simple story about cabin fever and about, you know, madness, really. Mm-hmm. And I think Jack Nicholson, you know, I'd have to sit down and look at his IMDb, but I want to say this might be his top 2 or 3 performances. Maybe A Few Good Men might be thrown in there as a little bit better of a performance. I think maybe he won the Oscar for that.
Mm-hmm.
But him as Jack Torrance in this, I mean, he, you know, we think of Jack Nicholson now as this kind of weird, like, kind of creepy dude and kind of sinister. That's because of The Shining. Like, I don't think people realize, you know, maybe One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was a couple years before this. But, you know, he's just that kind of actor that can be very menacing and very sinister. And he really develops into that throughout the course of this movie. And
yeah,
it's about 2.5 hours long. And by the end of it, I mean, he has descended into full-blown psychopath. And it's a little bit of a ghost story. You know, there's some spirits there in the Hotel Overlook. So it does have a little bit of the paranormal feel to it as well. But obviously, you got Stephen King. And I think Kubrick just made a horror movie, but he made like a piece of moving art that, in my opinion, will live on forever. I mean, it's in the Criterion Collection. This is one of the greatest horrors ever made, man. So since it came out in 1980, I had to put it on here, man. So that's my number one. What do you think?
Well, I think you're totally in the majority. This is, generally speaking, the number one whenever you talk 1980s on pretty much anybody's list. However, I watched it last night again for the second time.
Oh, okay.
Ever,
all right.
Because I thought, what did I miss when I watched it as probably a teenager for the first time?
Interesting. And I'm anxious.
as much as I appreciated it more last night in watching it, I have to say it doesn't hit me the way that it hits everybody else for two reasons. One, it's overlong. There are so many overlong shots and scenes, to my mind, in this film, and 20 minutes shaved off would have made it a much better film. Which is, I know, it's blasphemous. Oh my God, people are rolling.
No, it's okay. Punching. I mean, I'll never argue with making a film shorter. You know my little idiosyncrasy about hating long movies. So
yeah, I
won't argue with that.
At times, I was legitimately bored. I'm like, I know where this film's going. I guess that doesn't help. And I'm a big fan of the book, I should also add as well. And the book is more nuanced and blah, blah, blah. But that's fair. That's a book. The film itself looks gorgeous, and I was so impressed by the technical aspects of Kubrick's direction, so not taking anything away from that. As you say, Jack Nicholson's performance is awesome, but I was never scared. The only time the film gets frightening for me is in the last 10 minutes when Jack is running around chasing them, and more importantly, when his wife, Wendy, is seeing the ghosts herself for the first time. I think that's the best sequence of the film, and it just takes a long to get there. And killing off... Dick, when he comes back, was a real shock to me because I'd read the book and Dick doesn't die in the book at all.
Mm-hmm. I know, yeah. What I think, and I think to your point, you're right. I think to your point, though, what Kubrick was trying to accomplish, and actually one of the reasons why I heard that why King is not a huge fan of the adaptation either, is he was trying to really create a situation where you felt like as the viewer that you were slowly going insane with this family. And that's why... he purposefully drags certain situations on long because, you know, imagine seeing this in the 80s and being unsure because you don't have social media and the internet and everything else and you don't know what's going to happen unless somebody spoils it.
Would have been very impactful, for sure.
And you're like, oh, God, you know. So I can remember my dad seeing this, man, this movie and The Exorcist, and he told me that on those two occasions he left the theater.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He couldn't deal with the uneasiness that it was causing him. Now, I think The Exorcist is much more scary, to your point.
Yeah.
But The Shining is just a beautiful picture of horror that I feel like could be the poster child for horror movies. Do you know what I mean? Like, the imagery, I mean. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I know, I didn't know where you stood on it, to be honest. I mean, I knew you probably liked it, but I didn't know if you were, like, crazy about it or not.
No, so I'm not crazy about it, but I do like it. And the other thing I should mention why I find it very hard is I find it very hard to engage with Shelley Duvall's character in that she... As a this is horrible to say, as a person, I find her off-putting. And then second of all, as a character, I found she's so probably of the time, maybe it's fair in 1980 that this is the way that she was or women might have been generally. But God, watching it in 2020, it's just like, get in the car and fuck off. This guy is an abuser. And even the, and I get it. Right. It's all product of the time. And look, it happens these days. We just had this awful situation over here where a man murdered his family and the likes. It still happens. I don't want to pretend like a domestic abuse and violence doesn't. We're just so much better educated about it now that people are coming forward and talking about it mostly. So right. I found that part hard to engage with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know I love you, so this is just us talking. But I mean, I do want to give Shelley Duvall a little bit of love. I thought she was great.
Go for it. She probably needs some love.
No, I know. Yeah, she does. Absolutely. She needs a hug, man. But I mean, I've heard that you're not the first one, bro, and you won't be the last one. People often criticize her performance in that. You know, I didn't see the Room 237 documentary that people always bring up. I want to watch that, though. People keep bringing that up to me whenever I mention this movie. But I've heard that Kubrick was not nice to her.
Yes, and I've heard that too.
You know, basically tortured, not tortured, but I mean, he made it a psychologically, very torturous experience for her. And I felt like that came out in her performance, you know. But I'm in the minority in that case because I do always hear people criticize her in that film. But I don't know why. Maybe because I saw it, you know, when I was younger and I didn't really know about all that stuff yet. And it just kind of seemed natural to me that that's just kind of who she was. Kind of a submissive, quiet, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
So I don't know. But I mean, I like her in that film. I think Jack Nicholson is the star of that film.
Sure.
Along with the imagery.
Yeah. And he comes into it more and more. And I don't think Danny's a particularly good actor either.
Right. No, I agree with that. I like Dr. Sleep, though. Did you like that?
Yes, I did. I did. In actual fact, here's more blasphemy for you. If I had to say which one would I rather watch again, it would be Dr. Sleep. So,
well, it's a modern version. Exactly. And you saw it in real time, you know, so I think that probably has something to do with it.
It does.
Too.
It does, 100%. All right. Well, there are our top 10s, and I don't think there's a bad film among them. So that's nice that we could at least hit on some difference. Like yours is much more slasher heavy. Mine's much more sort of zombie, undead, demon heavy. So it's nice that we covered all the bases there. We won't talk about them because we are going to run a little bit long. But just run down your five honorable mentions then that didn't quite make the cut, Gerald.
Yeah, real quick, you mentioned two of them, but my 11 through 15 would have been Evil Dead, Christine, which was also a John Carpenter film and also written by Stephen King, Fright Night.
Yes, Fright Night, my honorable mentions as well.
An American Werewolf in London, really for the transformation scene alone. Rick Baker, I mean, really just that five-minute sequence. And then my number 15 would have been Poltergeist.
Okay. Mine are Prince of Darkness, another John Carpenter film, which some people hate and some people really love. The Hitcher, which I just left it off because as much as it's a great film, it's almost more, again, action road film than it is a horror film, but certainly has horrific elements. Creepshow 2, as mentioned. Fright Night, as mentioned. And the last one is a Dario Argento film called Opera, or Terror at the Opera, depending on where you are, because that had some disturbing shit in that movie and some incredible kills. So that's why it snuck in there for me.
Yeah, good. Nice rare gem. I haven't seen that one in a long time either, but that's a good pick.
Likewise, been a long, long time, but it's stuck in my head. All right, well, that is it for today. The top 10 80s horror films of the 80s have now been revealed for your viewing pleasure. If you haven't seen any of them and we haven't spoiled them too hard, get out and check them out. But before we get out of here, Gerald, I want to thank you so much for coming on, sitting in your cold, freezing your ass off on a Friday night in your garage.
I knew the thing was going to be on your list. I wanted to try to reenact it. You know what I mean?
Good.
No, man. Thanks for having me, brother. You know I love you. You've been on my show quite a few times as well, and I think this is number 3 or 4 to be on the countdown with you. And give my best to Wayne. But
I shall.
You know, we do a similar show over there, man. We just do a top 5 show. We do movies often, but sometimes we do music, pop culture stuff, TV occasionally. So if you want to check us out, please do. You can just follow us on Twitter at 2PsOnAPod, and that's T-W-O spelled out. And then we do host our show on Podbean. It's 2PsOnAPodcast, and you can find us on all the podcasters under 2PsOnAPodcast as well.
There you go. It's a great show. I have a lot of fun listening to Gerald and his array of guests, given that Andy's not always on the show. And
right.
Do check it out whenever. If you haven't had a chance to, please do, and pick your favorite topic and go from there. I'm sure you'll be hooked.
Thanks, man.
All right, that's it from us. Look, you know where to find us. No need to go through that. I'll be back with Wayne through the regular next Tuesday, and indeed our review coming out sort of depending where you are, Friday night, Saturday morning. Thanks so much for joining us for this bonus episode. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will catch you next time.